Hi, this is Steve. Last week, millions tuned in to watch the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians battle it out in one of the most exciting World Series of the last decade. Now, this one had everything. Great pitching, base running, rain delays, intentional walks, and game-changing home runs. But it also had something else. It had two cities hoping and praying that this year would end the curse. Because baseball is more than fast pitches and great plays. Baseball is about tradition and history. Superstition and character. It's about that moment when a hitter faces a pitcher, success or failure, hero or laughingstock. It will all be decided in a split second. But that second seems to last forever. There is perhaps no more dramatic moment in sports than two outs in the bottom of the ninth, and no movie captures that moment better than The Natural, directed by Barry Levinson and starring Robert Redford. With fantastic performances, an amazing score by Randy Newman, and beautiful cinematography, The Natural captures something both magical and nostalgic about this most American of pastimes. It's available for rental on Amazon and iTunes, and there is a nice Blu-ray as well. That's The Natural, one of the greatest sports films of all time, this week on The Cinephiles.
You know, my mother told me I ought to be a farmer.
My dad wanted me to be a baseball player.
Well, you're better than anyone I ever had. And you're the best goddamn hitter I ever saw. Suit up.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film. We explore its themes, its history, its filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. I'm John Rocha. I'm a voiceover artist and host of numerous shows here in Los Angeles, California, including this one.
That's right.
Yes.
And today we go deep into a film that, to me, is about America.
Yeah.
Because you cannot separate America and baseball.
Mm-mm.
They go together.
Almost as much as like as you can go back in time. Yeah, I guess the Revolutionary War and all that. But
they were
like,
not playing baseball yet.
No, but baseball was just around the corner.
Yeah.
You know, and when I watched that documentary that Ken Burns did,
yeah,
which was incredibly engrossing if you love the game, it's so far back. It's so far back, that game. And so this is one of those great films that really captures the love, the beauty, and the connection that people have with baseball in this country.
In a spiritual and mythic sense.
Yes, absolutely.
And the movie we're talking about is The Natural.
Yeah.
1984, Robert Redford, directed by Barry Levinson, based on the novel by Bernard Malamud. I don't know, it's one of the archetypal baseball movies.
Mm-hmm.
How did you first come to this film?
I think when I was very young, probably right after it came out on VHS or Beta, because my parents were huge Robert Redford fans.
Yeah.
And so we rented it to watch, I think, on Beta or VHS. It was very early in the 80s. And I remember watching it, and I just was in love with the film, in love with the story. And it was just at the time when I was beginning to understand adult themes and adult matters in movies.
Right.
You know, you have the Barbara Hershey stuff, you have the love connection, you have Glenn Close standing up as the lady in white, you have all these things that go through. And I was also beginning my love of sports. And so it just kind of hit at the right time for me. And it's always been one of my favorite sports films, bar none.
It's one of mine too.
Yeah.
And it's funny, it has those adult themes, but they're handled in such a delicate way.
Yeah.
That if you're a kid and you're not quite cluing into all of it,
right,
then it's just a beautiful baseball story.
Right.
For me, I think I saw it in the theater. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But for me, with a movie like this, like, I can't separate baseball and fathers.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And like there's just something about baseball. And I feel bad for my mom, because I've talked about my dad several times on this show. And there are movies that I definitely associate with my mom, but
right,
westerns and baseball is,
yeah,
about my dad. My dad was a huge Giants fan from San Francisco.
Okay.
And so when the Giants came to the West, he was 16.
Wow.
And so he went to see them at Seal Stadium. He,
right,
had, you know, so going to see the Giants was a big deal. My parents, right, took me out of school opening day every year as a kid to go to Candlestick Park to watch the Giants.
That's
play.
Amazing.
And my dad always had the Giants on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
It was just this part of my growing up. And even though I don't like baseball that much, like,
yeah,
as a sport, I liked playing it. It was fun. I played Little League. But there's something about baseball in movies.
Yeah.
I think maybe I said this before. To me, it's one of the two best sports for films.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other one being boxing.
Yes.
Boxing and baseball make for great movies. And there are great movies made out of other sports. Mm-hmm. And this one, to me, along with Field of Dreams, I think, captures the essence of how I feel about baseball and fathers and America and the mythology of traditional feelings more than any other movie I can think of.
Well, it's Americana, isn't it? I mean, this particular version of The Natural itself is Americana, is really baseball as Americana. The way that Barry Levinson shoots the film through the haze, through the softer lens, through all those kinds of things. I mean, the slow motion that he has when he chooses to use it, the sun behind Robert Redford when he's about to pitch to the whammer. All these things bring back that mythology of baseball from that time, which we feel existed at that time, you know, the good old days, that whole phrase of the good old days. Yes, it was when we had Negro leagues and there was segregation, so maybe it wasn't the good old days, but people remember it as that kind of nostalgia that really echoes within a lot of people for generations.
Well, and I think that's what's neat about this movie is it contains both the platonic ideal of the mythology and some of the dark side to this story as well.
Absolutely.
And so it doesn't say there's no corruption. Mm-hmm. It just says, let's believe in this ideal.
Well, when we get to Robert Redford's character, I discovered so much more watching it again for this podcast than I had remembered from before. Like, I think I forgave him more than I should have. And as I watched it now as a man in my 40s, I was like, oh, you kind of brought all this stuff on yourself.
No,
and you almost did it again.
Well, that's exactly the point.
Right.
I mean, so let's back just a little bit, because we definitely have to get into that.
That's true.
So first of all, this is a movie based on a book by Bernard Malamud.
Yeah.
And have you ever read the book?
No.
I read the book years ago, and I knew that I wasn't going to like it before I read it, because what I knew about the book is the book is very different from the movie, and the book is much darker. And here's this, again, we're going to give you this warning we always give you.
Oh, yeah.
This is a 30-year-old movie. We're going to spoil it. If you haven't watched the movie, you really should watch it. It's a lovely film. But this is where the spoilers begin. This is a story about a baseball player who had the greatest potential in the world as like a high school baseball player.
Yes.
Came from the Midwest somewhere, farm boy, you know, as pure as can be. Mm-hmm. And just on the verge of being a great success, he's a great pitcher. He's just struck out, who is essentially a Babe Ruth character. And then he falls for this woman who shoots him.
Right.
And she seems as if like she's a serial killer who's been killing off the best athletes in every single sport.
Mm-hmm.
And then he disappears for 16 years. And then as a 40-year-old man, he comes to a down and out baseball team called the New York Knights and emerges as the great hitter of all time, turns the team around, and then gets tempted by both a woman
again,
played by Kim Basinger, and also by money. Someone wants him to throw the big game,
right?
And the question, of course, of the film is he going to throw the big game?
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, he does.
Wow,
yeah, and the book is much darker.
What,
the character of Roy Hobbs in the book is really an opportunist. He's kind of a streetwise guy who comes and he's sort of playing the gamblers and playing people for his own advantage.
Interesting.
And it's a book that was written in the 50s from, as I said, Bernard Malamud.
Yeah.
And it was quite famous at the time. He's a Jewish American writer whose children of Russian immigrants loved America and was also excluded from America.
Interesting.
Was really struggled for a long time. The Natural is his first book that's successful.
Okay.
And it really shows sort of, you know, it's like both the movie and the book show the mythology of America against the darker sides of America. And in the movie, the mythology wins.
Right.
And in the book, the darkness wins.
Wow.
And it's really a condemnation in a way of America.
And now I want to read it.
It was really hard for me.
Is it a good read, though, or is it a bad read?
It is a good book.
Okay, it's a good book.
I can't give you an objective opinion.
Okay, okay.
I do think it's a good book. It was quite a famous book before the movie,
right.
And the movie eclipses the book, I think.
Gotcha.
And for me, I love the movie, so reading the book, it just hurt, you know? So I'm like, oh, no, I want to like this. I want to believe in this hero,
right.
And he's not going to give you that in the book.
Wow.
There had been a few decades where people wanted to make this into a movie, and finally it's in the early 80s. That they finally get a development deal. It's the first film of TriStar, The big key to it was signing Robert Redford to play the lead.
Okay.
Once he decided he wanted to do it, then it was in, and he's the guy who picked Barry Levinson.
Wow.
Because he had seen Diner, and he loved Diner. Mm. And you think about, I mean, this is Barry Levinson's second movie.
Right.
I mean, that's a lot of movie to have to handle.
Yeah.
With Robert Redford and Glenn Close and
yeah.
and Duvall and baseball. Very complicated scene movie yes. from Diner, which is kind of an indie, almost an indie film.
Right.
And the first decision that they make, Robert Redford and Barry Levinson are together, and they say, well, he's got to win the game. He can't throw the game.
Right.
And so immediately, and they knew, because it's a popular book, that yeah. they were going to be in trouble. And what's funny, looking at it now, it's like you can't imagine it any other way.
Right. It's one of those rare instances where they changed the ending of the book and people weren't upset about it.
Yeah.
Because, right? Yeah, because...
Now I'm upset about the book.
That's yeah. so funny. But it's such a great exploration of that time. You know, though, I love the name, the Whammer. You have the idea of the cynical sports writer, which was right there during that time in the 50s and 60s. That's what they were being.
And now.
Yeah, and now, of course. But and then you have the idea of the corrupt owners, which was like Comiskey with the White Sox, which yeah. is why they did the Black Sox scandal. Like, you always had these kind of owners that were in the game just for the money. And you still have it now, obviously. You know, there are some owners who, like, I would say Dan Snyder of the Redskins, who's my team since I was a child. I hate that guy so much right. as the owner of the Redskins, because he's a terrible, terrible person who puts a lot of terrible mojo on the team. And I think what you saw here, Robert Prosky, who plays the owner of the New York Knights, who's fantastic, who completely different than he is in broadcast news.
Oh,
completely
yeah.
different than he is in just about any film you've ever seen him in. He plays the more like just a little more evil and yeah, the hissing. And there's all of that in
it's
how he's
classic
playing.
Classic bad guy.
It is.
It's a great classic bad
yes.
guy.
Please pardon the absence of light. You see, as a youngster, I was frightened of the dark, and I used to wake up sobbing in it as if it was water, and I was drowning in it. But as you will observe, I have so thoroughly disciplined myself against that fear that now I much prefer a dark room.
The only thing I know about the dark is you can't see in it.
A pure canard.
What's a canard?
A prevarication.
What does that mean?
A lie.
The whole idea of the lights, like being in the dark all the time, yeah. all that thing. And then Darren McGavin, who's great. What a turn away from Christmas Story.
Yeah.
Playing such a kind of an evil guy, like a yeah. carny, an evil carny almost, you
yeah.
know?
And manipulative. And by the way, he's uncredited.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, he's
oh,
uncredited. Wow. Yeah, so what happened was they cast everybody else.
So weird.
Isn't it? They cast everybody else. And one of the things that happens in the casting process is all of the agents are yeah. angling for credit within
of course.
The film. And there's different meanings. Like, you'll watch... And starring this
right.
person with this person, and also starring this
yes.
person,
introducing
yeah. that person, and all of them are jockeying for position. Whose name goes first? Whose name goes
right.
last? So, for instance, it's really good to be first, and it's really good to be and starring Blake
yes.
at the very end. Not so good to be in the middle. Everybody doesn't want to be eclipsed by somebody else. And all of that stuff had been negotiating
right.
when Darren McGavin came on, and finally the decision was screw it, no credit.
What?
And what was interesting was apparently. That did really well for his career because everyone went, wait, where's his credit?
Who's, yeah, that?
Wait,
who's
wait,
that guy?
Who's that guy? And so suddenly he gets more work from being uncredited than
yeah.
maybe he would have gotten with the credit. He's
had
great
an interesting
in
career, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Called The Night Stalker,
yeah.
Christmas Story, all these weird things that he shows up in. He's so, so good. He's never not good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you get Duvall, who is a huge
oh,
star at this point.
Right.
And they were really worried about getting him because they're like, oh, is he going to take this supporting part?
Yeah.
And Duvall seems to be a guy that's like, you give him a good role, he's going to come in. And he's
oh, yeah.
great in that
He's
part.
So spectacular yeah. as this part. And because you kind of don't like him, but he's an interesting character. Like, you can't take your eyes off him. The way he speaks, even the 1-2-3 strikeout, he just does a strike three and he goes, you're out. Like, the surprise in
oh,
his
yeah.
mind that this actually happened was so well done.
Well, let's talk about that moment in the
yeah.
story. So let's back up a little bit. So the story is Roy Hobb.
Yeah,
and
Roy Hobbs. Yeah.
Roy Hobbs, and he's the young, up-and-coming pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And
by the way, can we talk about the fact that they're in their 30s playing 15-year-olds
yeah,
or 18-year-olds?
And
so
they do
obvious.
Great, they do, and it's so fun, because I remember when I was a kid, it didn't bother me at all. And now I'm watching, I'm like, man, they're really in the shadows there.
They are. Glenn Close is a woman. That is not a teenage girl.
And there's this... You meet Roy Hobbs as a kid, and
yeah.
he's the great pitcher. And then there's the really lusciously romantic American pastoral, you know, guy with a girlfriend on the hilltop in the
yeah.
shadow. And he's going off to the big leagues.
To the Mets.
Thinks.
Yeah.
And there's this moment where she takes him by the hand, and they're in the barn, and she says, it's okay.
Yeah.
And they move into the shadows in the barn. And that is beautiful storytelling.
That's how you make love without showing it. You because get it. You get it.
You get, well, I don't know that I got it at, you know, 13. No,
exactly. I didn't get it at 13.
But watching it now, I'm like, oh, they're saying they are now going to have sex.
Right.
For the first time. They're both losing their virginity.
Right.
And this is, and it's lovely and romantic and sweet.
But
and,
once again, it's Americana. It's America. It's absolutely how they view lovemaking back then.
Right.
Right.
And then because, and of course they know exactly what their lives are going to be like.
Right.
He's going to be a big baseball player. Yep. They're going to get married. They're going to own the farm.
Right.
It's obvious.
Right.
And of course nothing's going to happen that way because Roy on a train meets the Whammer, who's essentially the Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
We meet Barbara Hershey, who's mm-hmm. this odd, beautiful, mysterious woman.
A woman in black.
And they're at some train stop and there's a carnival and the Whammer is hitting home runs and Roy Hobbs is throwing strikes, you know, knocking down milk cans, and there's a challenge of I bet Roy Hobbs can strike the Whammer out in three pitchers.
Yeah.
And you have the first of our really amazingly beautiful sports set pieces.
Absolutely. Just seeing the way everybody is dressed, mm-hmm. then seeing the contentious nature of both the Whammer and then Roy Hobbs when he says, hey, watch your mouth, mister. Like, he is going back at Babe Ruth, who is the number one star in the world at this point. Like, essentially, Babe Ruth is standing in for Babe Ruth.
Yeah. I want to talk about that, but I want to say one thing first, which is, the film is beautifully shot by mm-hmm. Caleb Deschanel, who is Zooey Deschanel's dad.
Yes.
And also cinematographer for The Right Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the film takes a tremendous use of what's called magic hour. So magic hour, for those of you who don't know, is that time when the sun is just starting to set. And anytime you're out photographing or something and the sun starts to go down, now's the time to take pictures because everything looks great.
Right.
But really hard to shoot in because it doesn't last that long.
No.
And the light is constantly changing. So if you want to shoot a magic hour, you got to be ready and set up and shoot it. And they have those shots, particularly that slow motion shot of him pitching that is just lush and gorgeous and golden and perfect. And that's the first really, really good shot of Redford where you can really see him clearly. And he's old, but Redford is a really beautiful man.
Yes, he is.
He really is. And that shot, he looks great.
But then the way he pitches the ball and the slow motion shot of him throwing that last ball, just fantastic. And the reaction by everybody. And the skip punch. I love skip punch, which is exactly what a young man would do. Yeah. It's that excitement, but don't want to show too much.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
And then you see that moment when Barbara Hershey turns her attention from the Whammer to Roy Hobbs.
And this is one of the things I said it in another podcast that I always think about Redford is there's so much, you can always see the wheels turning when he's acting.
Yeah.
You can see the thought process. And so for him to play naive is really interesting to me. He did it really well.
He did.
Because he's not a guy who's naive.
No.
That's not who Redford is.
No.
He's a guy who's thinking.
Yeah. This is like, almost 10 years after The Candidate.
Yeah.
And he's incredibly intelligent on The Candidate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And now he plays very naive. And now we get Barbara Hershey. What a weird villain she is in this film.
Well, she's clearly unstable. And we have a somewhat introduction to her by what Max, which is Robert Duvall, is saying about to the Whammer about what he's reading in the newspaper that this woman is going around or this person is going around.
We know that these people have been killed.
Yeah, killing popular people from different sports.
Yeah, the top football player, top track star, something like that.
Right.
And isn't that interesting? And by the way, that's a really good exposition.
Yes.
Because it kind of gets thrown out there as this weird thing and you're not thinking about it.
Nope.
And then you meet Barbara Hershey and you see her turn to Roy, who's saying, I'm going to be the best there ever was in this game. And there's this moment where they sit down and they're in the train talking late into the night.
Right.
And she is talking about, and this is one of the first sort of thematic things we get.
Yeah.
She is talking about knights in shining armor.
Yeah, Homer.
Sir Galahad.
Yeah.
And Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey, which Roy has no idea what she's talking about.
No, he's...
Only Homer I know has four bases in it.
Homer lived ages ago and wrote about heroes and gods.
Oh.
And he would have had it in mind to write about baseball had he seen you out there today.
You know what? Someday, I'm going to break every record in the book.
And what will you hope to accomplish?
When I walk down the street, people look at me and say, there goes Roy Hobbs, the best there ever was.
Is that all?
Well, what else is there?
And then this moment comes where she says,
do you have a girl?
And he doesn't answer.
Yes!
And this is a betrayal.
Yes!
And this, to me, is one of the things about this film It's funny. We got into a conversation in about The Shining, about Room 237,
right,
and symbolism within film, and what are there secret messages in the film? And that's one where I don't see them all.
Right.
This is one where there are very, very clear symbols and themes within this film, and one of them is the idea of the knight.
Yeah.
The knight in shining armor, and that, like, Sir Lancelot is the greatest knight in the world, but he cannot get the Grail because he is not pure.
Right.
Because of his love for Guinevere.
Right.
This is the moment where Roy ceases to be pure.
Yes.
This moment, do you have a girlfriend?
Yeah.
And he doesn't tell her.
Right.
And that violates his knightly pureness.
Yeah.
And that is the choice that leads him to 16 years in the wilderness.
Yes. But then he still doesn't learn the lesson when he starts messing around with Kim Basinger.
Nope.
Same person. And even has that line where he says, "Boy, you're right, Memo. We have met before."
Yep.
And it's like, how many times do you need to learn this lesson? Even Pop came
to apparently twice.
Yeah, apparently twice. Well, if we don't know what happens when he gets on the phone with Glenn Close.
Right.
But like, even Wilford Brimley, who plays Pop, who's fantastic as the coach, the manager of the team, says to him, "Don't go after her. She's bad news. Yeah. I'm telling you not to do this." But Roy's desire for what he cannot have, Roy's desire for this unattainable, beautiful woman, rather than what he could have, is always his downfall. And I think this is what, when I was younger, I forgave him. As an older person, I go, "You got to take responsibility for your actions here, son. You are causing everything that happens to you in this movie."
Well, I think that is definitely what's happening.
Right.
And I think the movie says that he does. In the end, he does. But it's no question that he comes to the succubus, you know, that she is the,
yes,
you know, because that's when he starts losing.
Right.
The moment his, and this is why this is a mythic movie. I mean, it's like, it is not a coincidence that the name of the team he plays on,
yeah, the New York Knights,
is the Knights.
Right.
You know, and it's like the bat that he uses.
Yes.
Yeah, Knigget's, exactly. The bat that he uses, that after his dad died, a lightning bolt hits the tree,
yeah,
and he carves the bat out of the smoldering heart of the tree that symbolizes his father.
So great.
You know, I mean, like, this is Excalibur, exactly, yeah, as you can possibly get. And then lightning becomes a symbol throughout the thing.
Right.
They wear lightning bolt patches on their arms.
Yeah.
When he needs to summon his mystical power, lightning starts striking from the sky.
Right.
The explosion of the lights. I mean, this is a mythical movie.
Yeah.
And when he starts sleeping with Memo, his power is sucked away by the succubus.
Yeah.
And it is very clear that he is repeating the same sin that he had to start paying for. And he says a line, "Some things you never start paying for.
Some mistakes you never stop paying for."
Yeah.
Steve Morris, that line has been in my mind since the day I saw that movie. And when I've had situations with certain people in certain situations that have come back to bite me years later, I've always said the line in my head, "Some mistakes you never stop paying for." And it's true.
Well, one of the keys to stop paying for the mistake,
Stop making the same mistake. Exactly.
Stop making that mistake. And it's so funny. And it's funny. We talked about Kim Basinger in LA Confidential, where she gives a really stunning performance.
She is.
In this film, I don't know if she's given a good performance or not, but I hate her.
Yeah, but this is why I told you before when we did LA Confidential, I was not a fan of hers in the 80s. I thought she got by on her looks. It isn't until LA Confidential, isn't until she's older as a woman, as an actress, that she really brings power to her roles. And in this, she is just a mall. Like she was in Batman. She's just a mall. Nothing to be, M-O-L-L is what I mean. She's nothing right. of any note. Nothing of any note. She does her job well. She's a beautiful woman. She does. And yes, you do hate her because she's also very lost in a different way than Barbara Hershey was, because she's ruthless, but in a different way than Barbara Hershey was. You know,
but she does perfectly fulfill what is required of her for the role, because her performance is kind of weird and awkward and sort of stumbling and nervous. And I'm like, is that weaknesses in Barbara Hershey? Or, I'm sorry, in Kim Basinger's acting,
right?
Or is that weaknesses within the character that she's actually acting quite well?
Well, compare her to Barbara Hershey. Barbara Hershey's at the same age at the same time.
Sure.
And there's more power in
But
what
that's what's
doing.
Necessary for that character.
Right. I just don't think Kim at that time would have pulled off what Barbara Hershey could
do. My gut is that I agree. No, I totally agree with that. But I also go, well, she's, again, this goes to casting. Is maybe they just cast her perfectly.
Absolutely.
For where she was at that point to do the thing
Agreed.
That was required.
Agreed.
Because the minute she shows up, you go, no, it's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do this.
Right.
Like, we don't. And what's funny. It's funny. So back in the story, now 40-year-old, weary, worn out, Robert Redford, Roy Hobbs, shows up at the losing Knights team coached by Wilford Brimley, who, as you said, is great.
So good.
And Richard T. Farnsworth, who is great.
Loved Richard Farnsworth, yeah.
Just unbelievably great actors. And they're just put upon. And here walks in the world's oldest rookie.
Yeah.
And of course, Wilford Brimley's? No way.
Fella, you don't start playing ball at your age. You retire. Where'd he find you?
The Heber Oilers.
The Heber Oilers? I never heard of them.
They're semi-pro.
Did you ever play organized ball in your life?
I just got back in the game.
What does that mean?
I used to play in high school.
Freddy, you used to play in high school. That's nice. Scotty Carson signs him up. The judge okays the deal. Ain't talked to me yet. I got that in my deal for as long as I live. They gotta talk to me.
They got a contract.
I want to see it.
And it's funny. This is they're walking a fine line because you really like Wilford Brimley.
Yeah.
And he is a complete dick to this other guy you really like. And you understand why. And you're like, please give him a chance. Because, of course, we know the movie's called The Natural.
Right.
Like, if he sucked, we wouldn't have a movie. But he's really not cool to him. And there's this moment where he's not going to let him play. He's not going to let him practice. He's suiting up every day. And they have this fantastic montage where they're losing and losing. And you have the psychiatrist.
It's so great.
Losing is a disease as contagious as syphilis.
It's just so... And finally, Roy walks out and they have a fight.
Yeah.
And Wilford Brimley says...
We're sending you down, Hobbs. Class B ball. Tomorrow morning, you go to the Great Lakes Association.
Can you make the rules?
That's right. And you ain't been playing by it. All these other guys play by them. Don't you remember signing a contract?
Yeah, I remember signing a contract. To play ball. Not to be put to sleep by some two-bit carny hypnotist. I won't do that.
You're going down.
It took me a long time to get here, Pop. I won't do it. I can't. I came here to play ball.
Batting practice tomorrow. Be there.
I have been. Every day.
And that's power. Yeah. That's not giving an inch and still understanding that you're accepting what he's telling you.
And again, Redford is sincere.
Yes,
he has ability to just say, this is what I'm speaking from my heart.
Yeah.
And he has wisdom that he's brought with him. He has the power of truth.
Yeah.
The other thing he says, and maybe it's not in that scene, but he says, you play me, you get everything I got.
Yeah.
Now, and I was thinking about, because that's a thing you hear all the time. Like, if you watch any pregame thing for show, every athlete says, I'm going to give 110%. Mm-hmm. They can't. My heart is so big. They all say these things. And it's not that they don't mean them.
No.
But then I thought about, what's the difference when hearing that from a 40-year-old guy?
Yeah.
Because when the 40-year-old guy says, I'm going to give you everything I got, that guy, when Redford says it, you feel the 16 years of pain it took him to get here.
Absolutely resonates.
And you're like, yes, he is going to give everything he's got.
Yeah.
And Barry Levinson, he's such a deft director in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, so we should talk a little bit about Barry Levinson.
Yeah.
Didn't talk about it before. You know where he got his start, his first screenwriting gigs?
No.
Mel Brooks.
Oh,
he
that's
wrote
great.
Screen, High Anxiety. He wrote Silent Movie. He did a bunch of writing in the 70s and then Diner and then to this and had been a performer a little bit on stuff. And he's also one of those guys who has just an unbelievably great run of films for a few years. And then he does, he does Homicide. And he does. I'm not saying that he hasn't done anything good since, but boy, I love Diner, The Natural, Tin Man. I know we've talked
Tin
about
Man,
we
yeah.
both love. And of course, you have Good Morning Vietnam and Rain Man.
Right.
These are really good films. And The Natural, to me, shows unbelievable skill. And one of the things that I really like is he'll frequently be filming dialogue that's unimportant away from drama that is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And an example of this is we have... Farnsworth and Wilford Brimley playing Name That Tune with each other.
That's so
great.
And
this lovely scene. And during this whole scene, we have Roy Hobbs going out for his first batting practice.
Yeah.
And the sound of the bat that it makes is, and that them getting drawn into what's happening is pretty amazing.
Once again, it's the use of slow motion.
Yeah.
Because the hit of the ball is in regular time. The sounding of the ball as it hits the stands is in slow motion.
Oh,
which
you're right.
I think is great.
That's a good point.
That's so great because you hear the which is one of the most beautiful sounds in sports. And I wanted to make sure I said this on this podcast because they caught it perfectly in the film. There's almost no greater sound than the sound of a baseball hitting the bat at the right time. And it just sends you, it sends that ball so far out. And then he slowed the film down and you could see it.
Yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought about that. That's a great
because it's
point.
Once again, it's that mythical thing of these shots are otherworldly. Right. These shots are not seen. Like all he's doing is hitting a homers, but people are going nuts because he's hitting homers. What was everybody else hitting? And but there's a distance and a magic to his homers that they have not seen.
Well, and they do it beautifully with sound design. And I'm sure this was something they talked about.
Yeah.
Is like I know that when they made Raiders of the Lost Ark, they spent a lot of time trying to figure out what does Indiana Jones's punch sound like,
right?
And it must sound different from everything else. Mm-hmm. I am sure in this movie they said when Roy Hobbs hits that ball,
yeah,
it doesn't sound like anybody else hit the ball.
Yeah, because the bat is not a typical bat. He right. made it himself, and they have. I love that they go to that whole sequence, like old 1940s film, movie time news, yeah, where they measure the bat and weigh the bat and everything like that and to approve it. And that is great because that lets you know the wood is different. It's not the same kind of wood. It's homemade bat. And there's a once again, a mythical thing in that for not just us watching it as an audience, but what you would think the audience that are in the stands in the movie.
Right.
You know?
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
Well, and this is the weird, is that if you think about a home run in baseball,
yeah,
it's a fairly boring thing. If you remove it from the emotion of the game,
mm-hmm,
like if you watch, you know, Michael Jordan dunk the ball,
yeah,
that is an amazing thing to watch, uh-huh, even if you don't care about basketball. Mm-hmm. If you watch a ball fly 300 yards and land in some seats,
yeah,
that actually isn't that exciting. What makes it exciting is your emotional connection to the game.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And understanding the drama of the moment. It's not like watching a great gymnast do three flips in the air. You know right. what I mean?
Well, I would say yes and no, Steve, because I would argue that the hitter matters. Like Reggie's yes. form, Reggie Jackson's form, when he hit a homer, was one of the greatest things
You're right.
ever.
You're right.
And I think other people hit homers, it's not that big of a deal. But if there's a way that a certain hitter looks when they hit the home run, that just adds to the mythical nature of it all.
Well, and I think what you make actually exactly the right point. You're totally right, because it is not... It is the batter.
Yes.
And it is the bringing down to the minutia, the examination of the moment. And this is why I think baseball is really the greatest sports to make films about, mm-hmm, is because baseball comes down to small moments.
Yes.
And those small moments are very clear. Like when you think of the greatest moments in a football game, like to me, it's that great run.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of things. There's blockers and there's someone picked up this block and then he spun right. here and then he moved there. And there's a lot of stuff. If you think of baseball, the greatest moment, mm-hmm, is it's the hitter and the batter and it's anticipation,
mm-hmm,
and it's slow and it's all coming down to, is he going to hit the ball or not hit right, the ball? It's not right. complicated. It's simple and very cinematic.
Yeah. And also, if you compare, like you mentioned earlier in the podcast, boxing and baseball,
right,
it's man against man.
Man against man.
And yes, you have that in tennis, you have that in other things, but it doesn't quite work the same as it does for boxing and tennis. And I mean boxing and baseball. And I would argue, you're right, baseball is even better, because in boxing, you don't see the full technique even as you're watching. Right. It's about, does he have the heart to win? But in baseball, it's about the mental energy of the mental game that is happening. Am I going to guess the pitch that you're going to throw?
Right.
Are you going to guess the right swing about the pitch that I'm going to throw?
Right.
It comes down to that simplicity, that simple moment,
right,
you know, where you're outsmarting the pitcher or the pitcher is outsmarting the batter.
Well, and the thing too is, if you think about the greatest moments in a soccer game or in a basketball game,
sure,
or in a football game, you cannot create better than the greatest athletes doing those things
right.
in the real world. You cannot create better yeah. than watching Jim Brown run.
Yes.
You cannot create better than watching Pele. You could name right. 20 other people in soccer, sure, but sure. I can't. But you can't. So I pick Pele. Like yeah, we're sure. literally the world's most famous soccer player of all time. It just shows the extent of my knowledge. But anyway, because we can't get an actor to do what those people can do.
And I hate when they try because it never works.
Right. It's really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But in baseball, you can't.
Yes.
In baseball, you cannot have a moment filmically
mm-hmm.
as good as what you can do in a film in real life.
Yeah.
You know, because you get the slow motion. And this is one of the things, again, this goes into a sort of a filmmaking idea. One of the things I thought about quite a bit is that the power of editing is that you can extend time or compress time.
Yeah.
And frequently we compress time because you really don't want, if I have to walk a mile, you don't want to wait 10, 15, 20 minutes to watch a character walk a mile.
Yeah.
You're going to have them walk that mile in 10, 20 seconds.
Yeah.
So you're going to compress time, but you also are going to extend time.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I looked at, his last at bat.
Yes.
At the end of the game.
Right.
7 minutes long.
Wow.
Yeah. Because they're extending time. So for every moment to look at every single detail.
Right.
So that it extends time in this way that every moment becomes important.
Right.
You know? And so like, and that's a really powerful thing. And the amount of time they must have spent shooting that last sequence is insane.
But it's also believable. If you've ever watched the final at bat,
it goes forever.
It can go forever, right? Like I was watching the Kirk Gibson home run from the 1980 or 81 World Series where they in the first game against the A's, bottom of the ninth, comes out of the dugout. It's a 19-minute long video.
Right.
From when the first person gets on base to when Vin Scully starts talking about, or I think it's Jack Buck starts talking about Kirk Gibson and the stuff that he's going through and walking out into the, you know, stretching out and shaking the dirt off and doing everything. Sure. And by the time he gets to the batter in the box, it's like 7 minutes. And then he starts it. And it's foul after foul and the strike and full count. It's just fantastic. But that's also, once again, Steve, the mythical nature of the game
right.
within itself. You know, even now, you see it even now. Like when we're recording right now, it's 3-2 in the World Series.
Right.
Who knows if the Cubs are going to come back and win again in two games in Cleveland. That would be mythical in itself.
Right.
You know, and like what happened with the Cavaliers earlier this year coming back from 3-1 in Golden State. Like it's mythical in that fact. And it gives us inspiration. Like that's the people who don't watch sports to me are like aliens to me because I don't understand it. I don't understand how you can't watch sports. Sports is drama. Sports is theater. Sports is this. And it comes ready made with real people, real stories, real characters with real flaws and real amazing characteristics and qualities. And so when people don't watch it, who are big into theater, who are big in film, I to me, it's mind blowing to me that you don't understand sports.
Well, to me, it's funny because it's to some degree,
it's my diatribe.
No, I know. Well, this is one of the reasons I wanted to do this with you is because I know you're a big sports fan.
I really am.
And it's funny. I think I rejected baseball as a fan because maybe my dad was so much of one.
Right.
But I do get sucked in. And last night, we're at a party. The game was on.
Yes.
And so this is there's one point where the Cubs have the bases loaded.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God, this is the moment.
Right.
And I had this thought as I'm watching it. It's like, you know, when I was a kid and I was playing Little League,
yeah.
I always fantasized about being that guy that's up, you know, two outs down, bases loaded, bottom of the ninth, which again, why baseball is so filmic, because you can come to a moment where you know this is what it's about. Everything has come to this.
Right.
And I'm watching this guy, and I'm watching the pitcher and the batter in this moment, and I went, oh, I don't want to be one of them.
Yeah.
That looks horrible.
It is.
The amount of pressure and the knowledge that you're sitting there and going, oh, this is the moment of my life.
It's theater. That's
no question
it's
about
90,000 it. 90,000 people in a stadium looking at you,
and
going,
millions of people around the world.
Are you going to mess up the lines or not? It's amazing.
But but the thing is, when I'm in a play, I'm pretty confident I'm not going to mess up those lines. And not messing up those lines isn't that hard.
Gotcha.
Do you know what I mean? When you have to hit a ball,
right,
90 miles an hour, a thing that the greatest people in the history of the world do at best one out of three times of at-bats.
Yeah.
And it's like now it's down. You have one pitch left. You have one strike left. Now the odds are way against you, and everybody's looking, and this is going to be your life. If you messed up your line, if you messed up your lines on the Oscars, maybe that would have the same impact.
Sure.
But almost nothing else.
Right.
You know, like, this is big stuff.
Right. And that's why it drives me nuts that people are not sports fans, because these people struggle, and they work hard, and they dedicate themselves to be the best that they can be in this particular. And you know how we have 32 teams in the NFL? There's maybe 8 to 10 quarterbacks that are worth a damn,
right?
On the face of the planet, well, and that tells you that's insane.
Well, and this comes from thousands and thousands of high school kids playing football, right, thinking they're going to. And this is something that always amazes me, and it really applies to the natural, yeah, of what it means to be the best.
Yeah.
Because I remember, this is a boxing story, but I remember watching an Oscar De La Hoya fight, and he was fighting a guy who's like the European champion.
Okay.
And, you know, at the beginning of a boxing match, they always have the thing where they go, here's this person's history. So
right.
They show De La Hoya's history. And then they show this European guy's history. And they say he was the top sprinter, the top soccer player.
Right.
He was the most popular kid at the school. He was the smartest kid at the school. He's undefeated. He's the golden boy of every single way.
Right.
And you go, wow, this guy sounds really good. And then they say, and then they talk to, you know, the color commentator and say, so what chances do you give him? He says, he's out in two. Or maybe he said, I think he said he's out in three. And then Oscar De La Hoya beat him in two.
Yeah.
And I went, wow, what must that be to be literally the best in the world,
yeah,
that you've ever experienced and to be so far out of the league of, yeah, the person who's really good.
Right.
Like you think of all the great college quarterbacks,
mm-hmm,
and you are never going to be in the NFL.
Yeah.
And you
so
are
many
a star.
Of them.
Yeah. A star.
So many of them. But and that's what's so great, what you see with his story here in the film, in the natural. And I think baseball is the backdrop for the movie. Obviously, it is the central driving force, yeah, of him. But he is like anyone else. He has a talent. He finds out that he has an innate talent. Right? Can he hone that talent? And his dad even says that
right
to him.
Right
in
the movie. Yeah.
Right? His dad says that.
You've got a gift, Roy. But it's not enough. You've got to develop yourself. Rely too much on your own gift and you'll fail.
You've got to train it. You've got to focus. You've got to make it your life's work to be the best at this. And you know, and he is. He is a natural, but he's trained to be as good as he is because he takes that talent and works on it. And you see that come through finally when he's playing for the New York Knights and he turns the team around. They find a way to get him to come back after he's been hurt, you know, after he tears his stitches from the bullet. The bullet comes back to haunt him, which of course has that line. And he never apologizes to Glenn Close for having cheated, yeah, on. That's so interesting. But we should talk about Glenn Close too. I mean, we've talked about the movie without even touching about Glenn Close, and we should touch on her character because her character is so good with what could have been just a plastic one note, one level, yeah, character. And she gives so many levels to her, so many moments. The scenes in the coffee shop when she shows up to the baseball game, yep, she's the lady in white. He hits the home run. He goes.
Well, let's
out.
Set this up a little, yeah, bit. Let's set this up a little bit because so, yep, Roy Hobbs comes back.
Yeah,
finally, Wilfred Brimley lets him play.
Mm-hmm.
He's only substituting the moment because the head guy is Bump Bailey.
Yeah,
played by Michael Madsen.
The great Michael Madsen.
And I gotta say, my one quibble with the film
is he's so out of place.
He's really out of place, and then his death is really weird.
It's
just kind of comic,
but
in
it's
a way.
Comedic. Yeah,
So he dies.
Yes,
and so now Roy Hobbs gets
ironically played. Hustling for a ball.
Hustling for a ball.
The whole point was that he was not hustling anymore, and you find out he was in the pocket,
yeah,
of the owner
because he's dating Memo, who is the, as we, right, know, the kiss of death, and she is working for both the owner and the gambler,
right,
and wants Bump to lose, and Bump only starts playing hard because of Roy,
right,
and then he dies. So right. Now Roy's in the game, and he's just doing well. He's literally the greatest, and it makes me wonder too. He misses the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
How many home runs did he hit before he started playing bad when he dates Memo? It
right.
must be a ton.
Right.
Because it becomes very clear that this is the greatest hitter
yeah.
anyone's ever seen.
Yeah.
So he must be hitting 40 home runs or something.
At least.
Just crazy
probably.
Number of
yeah.
home runs. And then as soon as he starts dating Memo, he goes in the toilet.
The whole team does.
The whole team does.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why, and it's funny because we start with Dad saying, talent's not enough. You've got to work. You have
yeah.
discipline. And what we really learn is that this is a spiritual journey for
right.
him, is that he must be pure of spirit and then his talent will work. You know, it's like Samson mm-hmm. in the hair.
Yeah.
As soon as he starts dating Memo, he has no power.
This is a great point.
It all goes away.
Yeah.
Because it's not like a movie where it's like Rocky, where we have to train. There's
yeah.
no training in the movie.
Right.
He's either good because he's pure of spirit
yeah.
or he's not.
Yeah.
And now he starts to lose. And now we discover Glenn Close again, who
mm-hmm.
we know he slept with when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And she's just in Chicago.
They were sweethearts.
High school sweethearts.
Childhood sweethearts, yeah.
And she goes to the game.
Yeah.
And he's losing. He gets up to bat. He loses. He gets up to bat, strikes out. Gets
right.
up to bat, strikes out. And then there is a moment that is as remarkable, particularly in terms of lighting, than
yeah.
anything I've ever seen, which is she in a white dress with this translucent white hat stands
mm-hmm.
up with the sunlight streaming in behind her.
Right.
And he looks up, and we think she sees her.
Right.
And then he turns and hits the ball into the clock at Wrigley.
Yeah. But in that moment, you have the symbolism, right? The woman in white versus Barbara Hershey, the woman in black.
Right.
That the old school black equals bad, white equals good, that kind of old school stuff. Once again, because it's set up in that time of black and white, of what if things were that way. And so when he...
Well, and clearly this is a good and evil movie.
Yes.
This is not a movie of grays.
Well, yes. I think when we get to the Glenn Close situation, there's grays, right? Because she... You're assuming he never reached out to her again after he got shot. Probably from embarrassment.
Yep.
Right? But she, I'm assuming that's her child is his child.
Well, this is what's
and
so
it never gets really cleared up, does it?
They never say it.
No, they never do. So, they allude to it, but they never 100% concretely say it.
So he first he goes back to the diner and has and the scenes are so lovely.
They were great.
And this is, by the way, the term that we would use is in screenwriting for acting is subtext, which is that they're talking about lemonade. They're talking about baseball. They're talking about everything. And they're not talking about I left you.
Right.
They're not talking about what happened to you.
Right.
And they don't bring it up. And all of that, and that's what makes those scenes so good.
Right.
If you talked about it, you would lose all the juice.
I agree. And they also don't portray her as a victim who had been searching for him or wondering where he was. She said, I'm happy. Never got married again. I'm happy.
Yeah.
I never get lonely.
Never get lonely.
That's so great because she doesn't need him. There's a difference.
And you know.
In the 80s.
And in the 40s.
And in the 40s, right.
And you know she went through some pain.
Yes.
You know she went through some pain. But we're not going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And then he goes back to the house and he sees that there's a baseball glove and she says,
it's my son's. He means the world to me. He's a great kid.
I'll bet he is. I'd like to meet him.
He's coming home pretty soon.
Is he with his father?
No. His father lives in New York.
Oh, you're...
But I've been thinking that he needs his father now. He's at that age. I think he needs him.
Sure. That father makes all the difference.
Yes.
His father works
in New
York.
Which is basically alluding to the fact that it's Robert Redford.
Well, but they never say.
No.
Well, and this is the thing, too, is what does Robert Redford know and when does he know it?
Right.
And it does seem by the end of the film, he knows this is his son.
Right.
It's funny, watching that scene this time, that's the scene I really cried at.
Yeah.
It really got to me. And I think maybe it's because I have a kid. And so things about children become more real. But watching Glenn Close not tell him that it's her child.
Yeah.
But I love this moment where she knows, he knows, she knows, he knows, he knows, she knows, he knows. And there's this silent, but no one's talking about it.
Right.
And the feeling of this kid, and there's this moment where she says, he won't believe it, Roy Hobbs. And what she's saying on the surface is, he won't believe that I know Roy Hobbs and Roy Hobbs is in the house.
Right.
But what she's actually saying is I've never told him who his father is.
Right.
And he won't believe it when I tell him his father is Roy Hobbs.
Right.
That got me. That got me really hard. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's cool. I like that. My reaction to it was just great because it's once again, it's that's how people used to speak back then. The subtext. At least in my mind, right? My vision.
Well, in
of
this
what
movie?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The subtext is not spoken. It's just there. And a lot of people talk about from the older generations that I speak to sometimes, and they say to me, like, back then, we didn't do all that talking back then.
Right.
We knew when we knew, and we did what we did, and we had a responsibility, blah, blah, blah. And that's how it kind of was back then, right? Now we have all the psychoanalysis, and also we do a lot of that, which can be good and bad.
Yeah.
Like anything else, you know?
I think there are problems. I mean, I think about this. I think... In general, it's good that we can talk about our feelings.
Absolutely.
In general. But sometimes once it's out there, it's out there.
Yeah.
And sometimes maybe it wasn't so good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's the chance
like maybe
to take.
Having a silent understanding about what's going on was better. Because when you put something out there, but we can't fix it, there's nothing to be done about it.
Right.
Well, then it just lays there and hurts us all.
Right.
You know, it's like if there's nothing to be done. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we should all suppress all our feelings.
No, no.
And hold everything inside. But I think you're right. There's some problems.
You got to pick and choose.
Yeah.
Pick and choose your battles. Yeah, like anything else.
But and the pain of that to go, because he's already felt guilty, we know, for the relationship with Barbara Hershey and where it went. I believe you're 100% right that he was embarrassed and that he was filled with shame and he was lost and he could never go back to Glenn Close and face her. Mm-hmm. And now he's discovering as a 40-year-old man for the first time, I fathered a child with this woman and she's raised him without me.
Yeah.
Like the level of guilt. But because she doesn't say he's yours,
right.
Because she doesn't say where the fuck have you been? Yeah. She doesn't yell at him. She doesn't get angry. She doesn't. She says, I'm okay. Yeah. I don't get lonely. And he sees her strength. He can't step into that and say anything. He can't violate that. He knows.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Amazing writing.
As you read the book, does that scene happen in the book at all?
I don't think, like I said, it's a while ago.
Okay.
My memory is there's no lady in white in that way.
Ooh.
There isn't. He does. I can't remember.
Okay.
As someone who's read the book more recently, you can let us know.
Yeah.
But for me, I can't remember at this point. But my memory is that the Glenn Close character does not exist in the book the way it is in the movie.
Okay. Wow. Well, this is interesting because, because that puts a whole new element to it. Right, because this is what I enjoy about her portrayal and her... The way they construct her character, she's not a damsel in distress.
Not at all.
In any way, shape, or form. And when we talk about mythical stuff, she would be the princess in the tower, but she's not.
No.
She
honestly,
she has her
he's
own
the princess in the
yes,
tower.
Yes, he is.
She's the hero that rescues him.
She really does.
If she doesn't stand up in that scene, he's doomed.
Yep.
And that's why he says come. Yeah. And that's what and what happens when he is in the hospital?
Right.
Who comes and rescue him?
Right.
She does. And she understands him. And she brings so let's get to this part of the story.
Yeah.
He starts hitting again. Memo, her job is to sleep with him and control him and to help him to lose.
Right.
That is what
she's a cooler.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
And that is what the judge and Darren McFadden, the gambler, Gus, are trying to get him to do.
Yeah.
And there's this great scene, by the way, where she's on the phone with him and he's just seen Glenn Close and she is talking to him and says, no, I'm at home in my negligee and thinking of you. And then it ends up that Gus, the gambler, is just sitting there watching her.
Yeah.
And she lies. She has to make it look to Gus like she still has control of this guy, which she doesn't.
Right.
And then we're at a party when they're winning. They've just made it almost to the pennant, I think.
Yeah.
And there's a party at Memo's house. And then Robert Redford gets sick and gets rushed to the hospital. And every time watching it, I go, because there's one moment right before where
she poisoned him.
Does she poison him?
Yes, she poisons him.
Well, this is what I'm never sure of.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure. When she says, take this, eat this, it's her poisoning him.
It's subtle. I think that's what's happening.
I'm telling you that's what's happening. There's no subtlety in my mind. I'm telling you that's what she did.
Well, and this is what's...
Not a coincidence.
Is that how intelligent do you want to believe your audience is?
Mm-hmm.
And in this movie, they go, these people are intelligent enough to figure it out. And if they don't, it's okay. And the ambiguity... If they said, I'm going to poison him, you see her put a pill in it, and then she does that, it would not be nearly as interesting of going... Wait, did she poison him?
Yeah.
And the same thing's like, oh, it's your kid.
Yeah.
Is not as interesting.
Or it's okay.
Or
when
it's
she takes him into the barn.
It's
okay.
Is that, and this goes into, you know, one of the most important rules of writing is show, don't tell.
You're right.
And show, don't tell, which is deep, deep stuff. The more I think about it, the older I get.
Mm-hmm.
It is what the real thing to me is create it so it's active in my mind, in my imagination as the viewer. Don't tell me. Don't explain it to me straight up because then it's not active.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he ends up in the hospital
and
he wants to cut, and he is essentially told, if you play baseball again, you will die.
In a maternity hospital.
In a maternity
hospital. Because that's the closest one for him to get
closest
to.
Closest one there.
Yeah.
And the team is losing without him and he's got to make this decision. Do I play? It could mean my death.
Right.
And of course, the judge and Gus and Memo want him to not play.
Right.
And the judge comes and offers him, again, it's a reference to the Chicago Black Sox scandal. Mm-hmm. He says, I think $10,000 is the going rate. I'm going to double that. Here's $20,000. Because $10,000 is what they gave to the Black Sox.
Right.
And he's left with this choice. And Memo says what you think a loving woman should say is, baseball's not worth it.
Yeah.
This is your life. You're crazy to think that you should play. And what Glenn Close, she's the hero.
Yeah.
She comes to rescue him. She doesn't say that.
Nope.
She completely understands why he wants to play.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Why is he still talking to Kim Basinger? Why is he still talking to Memo if he has this thing going developing with Glenn Close? What is he doing? And this is an interesting thing to strip apart.
I totally agree, yeah.
Is it a misogynistic thing because of the time we were in the 80s, we were okay with this seeing this guy play both women at the same time? Or we were okay with this? We would not see this now. We would not see this now. We would want him to have resolution with the evil one before we would allow as an audience to accept him being visited by Glenn Close's character. Glenn Close's character is so strong, so powerful in the whole film. She is a constant. She is a constant and is so good that when you see him still messing around with Memo, he doesn't learn his lesson until she shoots the gun later. I almost cussed. I'm sorry. She doesn't.
I already swore.
Yeah.
It's little explicit tag is already on the podcast.
She says he doesn't learn his lesson until she shoots the gun. When he goes back to give the money back to the owner, says he doesn't want to be part of it and doesn't want to throw the fact that he took the money at all, I guess, is an allusion to what happens in the book, that he actually does throw the game. And so the fact that he even considered it, to me, is insane to watch in this film, because nothing leading up to that moment makes you believe that he would do it. And yet he takes that money at least for a night to consider it.
Well, I think it's funny you say they wouldn't do that today because we wouldn't today have, you know, in the 80s, maybe more sexist time, I think is what you're saying.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And what I would say is, yes, I don't think we'd do it today either, but because I think we're not as comfortable in the gray areas today as then. To me.
Oh, good point.
Yeah. This is a guy very clearly struggling with that same thing from when he was 20 years old that led him to want Barbara Hershey. And to be honest, you know, you look at the world, this is something guys struggle with.
Right.
I mean, look, I think there was just another Tiger Woods scandal.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like we've seen guys who literally have had their life ruined from, you know, womanizing.
Wanting to womanize,
And yet they do it again.
But this is interesting because in this film, it goes from him being a young kid with this older woman to him being an older man with this younger woman. Yeah. Once these are the two juxtapositions of what men find themselves in sometimes. Yeah.
And I think you're right, is that even though we're going, don't go with Kim, go with Glenn. Right. What the hell's wrong with you?
Yeah.
He doesn't just say, get the hell out of here.
And he doesn't.
He's still sort of trying to find a way.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to purify himself is literally to go through death.
Yeah.
He has to get up to that plate knowing I might die.
Right.
And that is what purifies him. Again, it's like it's a knight in shining armor.
Yeah.
You know, he has to pass the final test.
Yeah.
And there's the scene, which I find so moving. Sometimes it's the line you don't say that is the one that's really powerful. And there's a scene where Glenn Close is there, and they're talking about what he could have been.
Things sure turned out different.
In what way?
Different. For 16 years, I've lived with the idea that I could have been the best in the game.
You're so good now.
I could have been better. I could have broke every record in the book.
And then?
And then when I walked down the street, people would have looked and they would have said, there goes Roy Hobbs, the best there ever was in this game.
You know, I believe we have two lives.
What do you mean?
The life we learn with. And the life we live with after that. With or without the records, they'll remember you.
That day in Chicago, why did you stand up?
I didn't want to see you fail.
I wish Dad could. God, I love baseball.
I started crying. I have never cried at that moment ever, but I think it's because both of us have lost our fathers now as we're older, and that moment made me cry. I'd forgotten about him, his father dying in the film earlier. Yeah. It had been so long since I'd seen it, I'd forgotten how his dad died in the film, and so that affected me, but it wasn't until he said that.
Yeah.
Because every
it's
man...
an unfinished moment.
Every man, as they get older, when they've lost their father, misses their father in certain moments, and especially in moments of great decision. Because they were always a counsel for them. Yeah. And when he has that moment, I just started crying. It was such a great, I had to pause the Blu-ray because I was crying so hard because it was such a beautifully well-acted moment.
Oh, yeah.
And you're right, Steve, when he says, God, I love baseball.
God, I love baseball. And that is the finish. That is the, I'm not going to say the thing.
Yeah.
But we have a sense of what the thing he was going to say is. It's funny, even before my dad died, that moment always got me.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Always got me. And I think to me, and this is why, because even before my dad died, I knew that dad was connected to baseball.
Yeah.
Because there's something about baseball that's the tradition. Mm-hmm. There's something about baseball that is this way of coming into manhood.
Yeah.
There's something about baseball as this thing that fathers and sons and grandfathers can share. Mm-hmm. You can have the game of catch. And there's something about baseball, at least for me, that was always incomplete.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I can remember as a kid My dad worked really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, he worked six and sometimes 7 days a week. He had an optometric practice. He was always in the city. And then he had other work that he did. And he came home. And I remember as a kid going, Dad, you want to play catch?
Yeah.
He's like, not today. I'm tired.
Yeah.
You know? And the wanting the connection with Dad.
Oh, sure.
And knowing baseball was this thing to connect with. Right. And maybe not having it made me, even as a kid, going, because you want your dad to see you. I think that's what it is. Mm-hmm. When he says, I wish my dad could have seen...
Yeah.
That's the thing. We as young men coming into manhood go, I want my dad to approve of me in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that moment is about.
And that's ironic for me personally in a number of ways because, A, I was the first person to enjoy baseball in my family. Like we're a Latino family. My dad and mom were both immigrants from Bolivia, legal immigrants where anybody flips out on this podcast from Bolivia. And soccer was our thing.
Right.
So dad and I would go in the backyard and kick the ball to each other for hours.
Right.
That's how we developed. It was what Americans have for catch, for baseball. Yeah. And so, but I fell in love with baseball, but the correlations are, the sport is irrelevant. The correlation is what matters. Right. Right. And what you said, this idea of having your father see you. Yeah. It's so powerful. That moment. And we only get it when you're older. You only get that moment when you're older, I think, for real. You only really get the power of that moment when you're older. And for me, this is the most ironic thing. My father would be so proud of the man I am now, but it took him dying for me to become the man I am now. That's what's so insane to me. That's what's so, like, such a great, colossal, in a way, cliche, but also a truth. Like, the man I am now, my father would be so incredibly proud of. And this was the man I was trying to be while he was still alive, but I couldn't. I wasn't there yet. And it took his dying to grow me the fuck up and understand, you know? And so that's what's so great about that moment. It hit me. That's why I cried, because I was like, oh, I get it.
Well, this is why, this is why we have myths.
Yeah.
We don't have myths because I'm going to go fight a dragon.
Right.
We have myths because myths are symbolic of our journey into adulthood.
Yeah.
Both men and women. And this is, you know, if you read Joseph Campbell, if you read The Hero's Journey, Hero with a Thousand Faces, this is what it is that we have to go through the trials.
Yeah.
And because we have to go from the child to the adult.
Yeah.
And as the adult, I remember when my dad was dying and I was like, oh, man. This is the real grown-up shit.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm dealing with, and as you grow older, you start to go, I don't know if you've had this experience where you kind of go like, oh, now I've done that.
Yeah.
Now I've done the dead parent. Now right. I've done this one.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've had the close friends get to the divorce or
right.
now I've been around I've had the serious health issue. I've had the, like, oh, that's what this is like.
Yeah.
And it's very different from how you look at it as a kid. Mm-hmm. And as you go through that and you're like, oh, I'm taking on adulthood.
Yeah.
And it's funny that it actually takes, I hadn't thought about it quite this way before. Even though Roy Hobbs comes into that ballpark as a man with great experience, much more experience than the kids he's playing baseball with, he doesn't become a man till the end of the movie.
No, right, exactly.
That is the moment of manhood, you know?
Yeah, because he, like you said, he has to go through death to be reborn, which is ironic because he's in a maternity ward. It's that little quiet symbolism of being reborn. You know, he's being reborn as a man.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, that's great.
Of course. It's all there. Like, to me, it was like, oh, this is, of course, this makes the most sense because it's ironic that it's a maternity ward. It's ironic, but he has to be reborn, right? To be again, to be who he was supposed to be from the beginning. And I think it has to go through these trials and tribulations as our hero would go through to achieve the ultimate goal, which is when he hits that ball out of the ballpark and when you see the lights. It's such a, I mean, one of the most iconic moments in film ever to have him hit the ball into the lights. The sprinkling of the lights, you know, coming down on people, like once again, and the sound. We should touch on the music definitely real quick.
But we're gonna do more and touch on it.
Okay,
it's
but you
good
can
stuff.
That like with the lights all coming down and the all the fireworks coming on top of them, you know, and the guy in the stands going, "Holy shit!" You know, without hearing him say it, all of that happens, and it's so great because it puts it all in. It's like it completes the circle, and. Who knows if they win the World Series? I think he never comes back to play baseball after that one year. I think he goes and builds his life.
I don't think he comes back after this hit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this is it.
Absolutely. And it's such a great way to go out.
Well, and that moment, first of all, it's a 20-minute game.
Yeah.
It's 7 minutes of build of just that at bat.
Yeah.
It is all of the details of all the characters, the fans, moving from the oh, by the way, do you know who the announcer is?
Bob Costas. No.
It's Barry Levinson.
Oh! how great.
Yeah, they were trying to get, and it's mostly improv. That's him just improvising. Wow. All that goodbye, Mr. Spaulding.
Yeah.
And welcome to the majors, really? Mr. Hobbs. And that's Barry Levinson.
Levinson?
Yeah.
He did a great job.
Really great job.
When he talks about the Nebraska farm kid coming up to pitch,
oh, yeah.
once again, in slow motion, Levinson does that. It's so great.
And that's his parallel.
Yes.
Because he's now facing the young version of himself.
Absolutely.
And I think that ball hitting those lights mm-hmm. is among the top five great climaxes, moments of yeah. moments, to me, bigger than the Death Star exploding.
Wow.
Like, it's so cathartic.
I would agree with you.
Now, I had to think, I'm going to hesitate a little bit on what I just said, because okay. I can't go back to when I was nine and saw Star Wars for the first
right,
time,
right,
which
right,
might
right.
have been the greatest movie orgasm moment.
But does it still affect you in the same
no.
way? And I think this still does.
This still does.
Yeah.
This still does. The build to this is so powerful.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the music.
Okay.
So the score is Randy Newman. He had barely done anything in terms of film scoring before this.
Right.
He had scored a couple of movies.
Yeah.
And Randy Newman, if you knew him in the 70s, was this guy who did these kind of weird,
yeah, short people,
funny, like yeah. how am I supposed to feel about this sort of songs? He was like a alternative singer-songwriter guy.
Yeah.
And Barry Levinson is the guy who wanted to hire him. The yeah. studio was like, how could this guy possibly do this movie? Randy Newman didn't think he could do the movie.
Wow.
He thought this was way out of his realm, and wow. he was terrified.
Wow.
Yeah, because he had the big orchestral yeah. sweeping, and there's nothing sarcastic about this music
nope.
at all.
Nope.
It is straight up
mm-hmm.
American, hopeful, you yep. know, swelling orchestra.
40s, 50s stuff.
Yeah. yeah, and there's one day where they're in the editing room, and Randy Newman's like two doors down, kind of working on the score, and they start to hear this theme, da-da-da-da-da-da, coming from the sound. And Barry Levinson goes, well, if that's our theme, this is going to be good.
Oh, wow.
And it is, it's one of my favorite soundtracks in the world.
Absolutely.
It is so good.
It sweeps you up. It
yeah.
sweeps you up into the moments of the film. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And even when they're doing, when they're on their streak and they're winning all the yep. all the games, yes. all that is just great. Just great. You get caught up in it. You're like in the joy of it all, you yep. know?
And the dun 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 dun
yes.
dun dun. It's so rousing. It's so filled with that sense of Americana.
It is.
And this is one of the other things. So we talked about the mythic elements of
yeah.
it. And there's another one I was thinking about too, because Barbara Hershey's character mm-hmm. brings up the Iliad and the Odyssey
right.
and Homer. And I was like, oh, well, in the Odysseus, he mm-hmm. goes away for 30 years.
He does.
And he finally has to come back to his wife, Penelope.
Yeah.
And to prove who he is, because he's unrecognizable
yeah.
now, he has to pull back the bow that no one else can pull and shoot it, you know, through 40 axe handles or something.
Right.
And it's like, man, that's what Roy Hobbs has to prove
yep.
with Wonder Boy
yeah.
to Glenn Close that he is still this man.
Right.
That he is the young man that she fell in love with is inside of him.
Right. And I think which is great is that he has to use the purer bat
yeah.
in order to hit the ball because
oh, yeah,
Wonder Boy
right.
breaks. Wonder yeah. Boy breaks
Wonder Boy
on
breaks.
That foul ball, and it's because he has to use the bat that was made from a purer place.
From the bat boy with the highest voice. It's like,
yes.
like, dude, I hope you went through puberty after this because... That is,
but it's so great that he has to use that bat that
yeah.
they built together, you know,
yeah.
because it's the legacy. He's passing on the legacy, and
mm-hmm.
it makes the most sense.
And that's part of how the movie is filled with these American
yeah.
moments with the cards and the kids
yeah.
and the newsreel footage and all of these things that harken back to what really wasn't a better or purer time.
Yeah, right.
But we can romanticize it.
Of course.
And this is one of the things that's in the film, too, is the difference between the pastoral America
mm-hmm.
and the city America.
Yeah.
And the pastoral America is perceived as pure and
right.
bucolic and beautiful and wholesome.
Right.
And the city America is corrupt and violent and... Now, I don't agree with those things.
Mm-mm.
I think we're all messed up and all good.
Yes,
and
of course.
But that those themes still exist within America, and it's
yeah.
played beautifully here.
Yeah.
I mean, like, even with when we first meet Robert Duvall, who we have to talk about more,
yeah.
and Whammer on the Train, they are the corrupt city folk.
Yes.
And Roy definitely is like, you can't talk to him like that.
Yeah.
Hey, mister. You know, because
yeah.
he is the pure country folk.
Yes.
And Barbara Hershey, she's city folk.
Well, yeah. Know? And that's why she comes off in the way that she does, right? Everybody who he encounters from the city initially is rejecting of him.
Right.
And judging of him, right? And or wants to use him.
Yep.
Yeah.
And what does Wilford Brimley want to be? He wants to be a farmer.
Yes.
I should have been a farmer.
It's so great. All the stuff with him is so good.
I should have been a farmer. I should have been
a farmer. My mother begged me to get out of this game, but I didn't listen.
And then there's that moment where Wilford Brimley, end of the movie, when Roy's going to come back, Wilford Brimley says,
"You know, my mother told me I ought to be a farmer.
My dad wanted me to be a baseball player."
Such a great moment, man. Yeah. It's a great end of the circle from when he started not playing him at all to where he has to, where he admits that in such a pure way. It's so great.
Yeah, it's a really satisfying movie.
Yes, agreed.
Okay, Duvall.
Yes, Robert Duvall.
He's a fascinating scoundrel, I think, in this movie.
Yes.
Because...
And I hate him.
Do you hate the character or you hate Robert Duvall?
No, I hate the character. He's such a jerk.
I hate and like him.
You do like him?
Well, in the sense that we've talked about liking certain villains.
Oh, right. Yeah, fair enough.
I mean?
Yes.
Like, I enjoy him on screen.
Oh, yes. He's great on screen.
And there is a scoundrel purity about him because he does care about the story.
Yes.
He really... And when he draws... When we see him draw the strikeout of the whammer,
right,
and we go, oh, now he's found a new story.
Right.
And there's this great line, which I feel like I brought up in another podcast, where Roy Hobbs says, "Did you ever play the game, Max?"
Yeah.
And he says, "No, but I make it a hell of a lot more fun to watch."
Yeah.
And that's a really fascinating sort of...
That's the classic player versus writer argument that we still have now. Kevin Durant is doing that now with the Warriors in the NBA. He is going after all the writers for coming after him for going to Golden State.
Right.
And so it happens all the time. And it's because these writers are not athletes. And so a lot of these players get really mad at them judging them.
Right.
Like, you've never done what I do. How could you possibly write about what you've never done?
Right.
You've never been where I've been. How could you speak about it so knowledgeably? And how can you influence the public to look at me and say things to me in a certain way when you've never done it?
Because they frame the game.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there was this time, I mean, the big reporters, big sports reporters, they were hugely powerful.
Oh, yeah.
In a way that I don't think they are now.
No.
I mean, they're still important sports reporters.
Sure.
But not that every single person reading about baseball would read.
No. Those days are done. Like, Dick Schaap was one of the last ones, you know, and he passed away a few years ago. So his son is nowhere near that level. So it's like, those guys aren't... you see the sports writers nowadays, they're on TV, they're doing things. It's nowhere near the power that they used to have. Because we have the online community, people blogging. So there's all kinds of voices now that it gets washed out.
Well, and this is where I wish, as much as some of these people were powerful and not good...
Yeah.
And I do like the fact that we have Rotten Tomatoes and Yelp and all these places where everybody can voice their opinion. Having the great experts to talk about a certain thing. You know, we talked about this when we talked about When We Were Kings.
Yeah. George Plimpton and Arthur Mailer. Norman Mailer.
Norman Mailer and George Plimpton.
Yeah.
Having these great voices to speak at a time, that was kind of neat.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing I don't like with Robert Duvall's character.
Okay.
It bothers me that he's in with Gus and the judge.
He has to be.
Not to me. I wanted him to be pure. Pure self-interest in the sense of, I'm after the story. I didn't want him to be after money.
But you can't turn a fan base against the team without having a sports writer in your pocket to write stories that you pay him to write.
That's true.
That's what they were using him for.
And no,
that's
I agree.
What he willingly took the money to do.
I understand. I wish that he had just been separate.
If it helps you feel any better, I still think it would have been a cynical jerk from the beginning. He's just getting paid to do it, even more than what he's getting paid by his employer at the newspaper.
Gotcha.
I think he's still a cynical, pure jerk. I think he'd have written these stories anyway.
Yeah. I think I like the guy who's just, I'm trying to write great stories.
Yeah.
I wish it seemed unnecessary to have him in that one scene and introduce him to Gus.
Yeah.
Like, I don't feel like that was necessary.
Okay.
It's just me. Okay. It's just me. It's just me. All right.
But one thing I do want to say is I like that he gets his comeuppance with the foul ball into the glass.
Oh, yeah.
With the Roy Hobbs hitting the baseball to hit him while he drops the camera. He does get his comeuppance a number of times in the movie. One last thing I want to say is I love the fact that this is one of those movies where they find these character actors to play members of the team and they're so natural.
Oh, yeah.
Like Hoosiers. So natural.
Yeah,
and they almost none of them work again. But they're so good on the team as players and believable. And you buy into what they're doing so well.
Well, one of the things they said is they really tried to cast people who could play baseball.
Yeah.
Which is hard. And this may, we'll put this down to legends of behind the scenes stories.
Sure.
But they say Redford could really hit the ball. But you usually hear this you hear sports movies.
I would like that to be a separate TV segment we do in the 80s. Legends of behind the scenes stories.
Behind
with
the
some
scenes.
Terrible super that comes up in yellow.
Welcome back. In 1934, a behind-the-scenes video was made before there was even video, which was remarkable.
Ronald Reagan could really run the ball in Newt Rockne, All-American. Great. I mean, just... anyway, all right. There we go.
So, but...
final thoughts?
So, final thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, the love I have for this film can't be quantified by words, and it was great to revisit it.
What about
it
by
again.
Numbers?
It's definitely top... five sports movie, maybe top three, top two, maybe even
top two sports movies.
Yeah, wow. Possibly. I mean,
it's up there for me.
I like Field of Dreams, but Field of Dreams loses a little bit because you don't actually see a game.
I don't. Yeah, I so think for Field of Dreams. It's almost not a sports movie.
Yeah,
it's a great movie. It's no criticism of Field of Dreams,
right?
But it's not. They're not having. It's about the myth.
It's about
of
father
baseball.
And son.
It's about.
It is.
It's all the stuff we talked about.
Yeah,
if about mythology and father and son and tradition and America and pastoral. That's all in Field of Dreams. And what isn't there is sports.
Yeah. And so I would, if you haven't seen the movie in a while, I would encourage you to go back and watch it, especially after how we talked about it. Really sit down and enjoy it and let it wash over you again. You know, remember it as you used to watch it, but then watch it again with these different eyes, because I think the great movies you can always watch over again at different times in your life and get different things out of them. And I think this is definitely one of them. And I certainly did. So I couldn't recommend this highly enough. And just one of the most perfect love letters to baseball I've ever seen on film.
Yeah, it's definitely worth watching. And I think that looking at this view of America and looking at this view of the mythology of America is really great, because we live in a really cynical age, and maybe every age is really cynical. I don't know. But it certainly feels like we're in a dark place. And looking back and trying to find that connection to what America is supposed to be and to find the... You know, this is a spiritual movie.
Yeah.
This is a movie about power and truth coming from goodness.
Yeah.
And this is about a character who goes through hard times and comes out the other side. And this is about a team that goes through hard times and comes out the other side.
Absolutely.
And this is about a family that goes through hard times and comes out the other side. Mm-hmm. And that the hopefulness of it is something we need. We need a lot of this right now.
Yeah.
Because it's not a very hopeful moment.
No.
Yeah. And so it's worth watching again. It's worth shedding a tear. It's worth putting that soundtrack on your way to work.
Absolutely.
And feeling a little better. And maybe you can get a little lift in your shoe and start looking at this world like there's a little more hope than there was before.
I like that, Steve.
All right. So that is it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.